Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at EPLRoundtable@gmail.com.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me back on. Really good to chat again. Anyone that's interested in any Chelsea content can find me on Twitter at StephenClark264.
And I'm Dan, Arsenal fan. You can get me on Twitter at @_jersey_fits.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me today, guys. It's another international London club podcast here with Stephen from Australia and me and Dan from America. But we hope you won't hold any of that against us. I figure we'll start off with Chelsea. Obviously had a very big win against Manchester City. Leicester also kind of in the top four currently, despite a disappointing loss on Friday. I was just curious if you think that they're going to be able to do enough to stave off the rest of the chasing pack or not.
Yeah, well, personally, I do think that Leicester probably is now the team that you're going to be able to catch if you're one of those teams outside looking in, a West Ham or a Liverpool. I think that kind of their form has curtailed in a similar way to last season as well, where they obviously dropped out in the last day. If you look at their fixtures as well, I think they've still got to play us away, and they've also still got to play Manchester United as well. So I think that if you are a Liverpool, potentially now maybe is the favourite coming in, Leicester is the team that you'll be looking at to take their spot.
Yeah, I think Chelsea's pretty much safe. You know, it's not officially safe, but they're in a very, very good position and they're a very good team. So I think they'll be all right. Leicester, on the other hand, I think are in quite a bit of trouble. As Stephen mentioned, their fixture list is extremely tough. And if Liverpool win their game in hand, they'll be only 3 points back and likely be able to catch them on goal difference. So they'd have the tiebreaker. Not that Leicester can't do it, but I'm not sure I'd consider them favorites in any of their remaining games. I guess Spurs, they'd probably be favorites to win, but there's a good chunk of a large chance they could draw, which
yeah, we always have wild matches.
Yeah, which is also, it's not quite as bad because they'd be 3 points up. So a draw is still useful, but it's any drop points are pretty dangerous from at this point. So considering their fixture list, I think they are in a lot of danger. And I think Liverpool is absolutely has a chance to catch them and make the top four pretty much what we expected going into the season, despite all the crazy teams that flittered in and out throughout.
Yeah, that's interesting. Both of you seem to already lean Liverpool. Do you think they're the only ones with a real chance of sneaking in there, especially after West Ham and Tottenham lost at the weekend?
Yeah, I think that West Ham loss to Everton last night was probably really telling, because I think now it's a 5-point gap to Leicester City. I think they would really have to pretty much win all their games from here on out to secure the spot. But even to be honest, looking at Liverpool, I mean, they're probably winning that Manchester United fixture is equally as important as well. So it will be really tough for someone to make up that distance. And you would, if you are one of those teams, you probably are hoping that Leicester do lose at least two out of those three games. Otherwise, you don't really have a hope in hell. I probably would have Liverpool as the favorite to sneak into that fourth spot.
Yeah, well, the loss to Everton was a real, real dagger for West Ham. Because as Stephen said, they're 5 points back with three games to go. That's just very unlikely. The fact that Leicester's fixture list is as hard as it is means it's not over, but it's very unlikely for them to make up that much ground in so few games. And they have to Liverpool to worry about, because even if Liverpool only draw that game to Manchester United, that would put them level on points, and Liverpool have an eight goal advantage and goal difference, which with only four games for them and three games for West Ham is pretty tough to make up. So not only I think, will they struggle to catch Leicester. They'll also struggle to fend off Liverpool, even if Leicester drop a lot of points. So I think they would have stood a really good chance if they'd beat Everton, but they didn't. And now their hopes are really, really hanging by a thread.
Yeah, and you mentioned that West Ham basically needed to win that one. I think that's exactly the same case with Tottenham, is they basically had to win out and see where their cards fell, and the loss to Leeds pretty much the final nail in their coffin as well. Just while we're talking about these two clubs, obviously we'll get more into Chelsea with Steven when we get into making the rounds, but a little bit more about Leicester then with Brendan Rodgers. So he's obviously being tipped with the Tottenham job. He's already said he wants to stay at Leicester. Apparently they're getting Boubacar Soumaré, which is a great signing as well. But if they fell short yet again, if they don't win a trophy there in the FA Cup final, what would you think about Brendan Rodgers as a managerial prospect, considering he would have fallen short at the final hurdle so many times?
Yeah, it's always been a really difficult one with Brendan Rodgers, because I don't think anyone would deny that he's a really good coach, and he obviously improves the teams that he's at. Obviously, you look at his Swansea side in the early 2010s, and then his Liverpool side, and now his Leicester side. And what he did really well with each one of those teams is create this kind of attacking side that really flourishes in the just kind of going out and demolishing those teams early, scoring lots of goals. He's also underrated, I think, at actually creating superstars as well. I think if you look at some of the players over those teams, you would arguably say that he is the one that made Raheem Sterling the player he is today. Even, you know, someone like a Gylfi Sigurdsson has a lot to thank, I think, with Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah, Sturridge had injuries, but he was never the same after Rodgers. Yep.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. I think you can look at those years, and even you look at someone like Luis Suarez and say he's inevitably going to be a superstar anyway. But I think that was definitely his best goal scoring season under Rodgers as well. So, you know, he's clearly got something about him. But I guess you would have to say, if they did drop out of the top four and lose the FA Cup final to Chelsea, that you'd probably have to say the same thing that you said about his Liverpool side, that he's just not one of these guys that can get him across the line. And I think that is something that is really important in the modern game. You know, there's a lot of coaches that have garnered these reputations of being really strong attacking coaches, but can't get across the line. I know that was kind of something that was thrown at Mauricio Sarri, rightly or wrongly, when he was at Chelsea for a long time, up until he won the Europa League, was that he wasn't someone who had experience winning trophies. And I think that if you are a top side, that's definitely something that you'd look at, and you may pass on Rodgers just for that reason.
I think it's a bit harsh to criticize someone for not winning trophies, or for not winning a trophy and not getting top four at Leicester, which is not a top four club. Like, even being in the race, I think, is an overperformance. I understand that they were in a good position. And obviously falling out at the last hurdle is never fun, but the fact they were even in that position in the first place, I think, is a testament to the fact that I think he's a pretty good manager. I've always had him in my head as upper Europa League level, not quite a Champions League level coach. And I think his stint at Leicester has probably fortified that thought. But maybe he could reach the Champions League with a better team. I'm still unsure. I still have him more as a Europa League level manager in my head, but I think I don't think he'd be a bad appointment for a team like Tottenham, who have been struggling, but still a lot of talented players, that he could maybe, you know, get them back into the Champions League just because they had the talent. I'm not really sure on that, but I don't think he'd be a bad appointment. And I think the criticism that he's kind of a choker is a bit harsh, when, like, this season specifically, so
just like the script makes him look worse. Like, if they had struggled all year and then push strong at the end of the year.
Yeah, exactly. And both this season and last season, Leicester have strongly overperformed their underlying numbers, and then they just kind of come back down at the end of the season. Like, currently they're plus 10 expected goal difference and plus 20 actual goal difference. But no matter how you slice that's a big overperformance, them falling back at the end of the year. And even, like, you want to look at it right now, just for fixture list. Like, if they were in the same position, but their last three games weren't against United, Chelsea, and Tottenham, then they'd be in a much better position. And if there'd be a much better chance they actually get top four. But because now they have those incredibly tough teams at the end, if they don't get it, we're going to call them chokers, despite, like, that's kind of unfair. Or if they had those teams earlier, they wouldn't be in this position and we wouldn't be able to call them chokers because they wouldn't be in a position to choke. It's just kind of how stuff lines up has been a bit unfair. Also, that reputation started at Liverpool when his team won 12 of his last 14 games, which I know they did. Really seem like they choked, but I don't think that was on him at all. And they did very well to finish the season. That City side was just also a juggernaut. So I don't think the choker reputation is all that fair. I think he's overperformed at Leicester in his tenure, and just not winning a cup or not being able to overperform with a team. I think that's a pretty unfair reason to not hire someone.
Yeah, and to be fair, they still have a chance to do both things. They still have a chance to sit top four. They're currently in there, and they are in the FA Cup final. But yeah, I was just wondering your thoughts on if they fell short. But yeah, all excellent points from you guys there. We'll move on next to talking a little bit about the elite of the Premier League. Don't worry, we're not going to talk ESL yet.
I guess I'll leave if you leave the Premier League.
Yeah, I guess me too. Steven, you're just going to have to carry the ship on your own.
Yeah, okay.
Yet again, just like 2 years ago, three or more Premier League clubs have made it to a European final this season. And I'm just curious, obviously we don't have like the English connection because none of us live there, but do you take any pride in the fact that multiple Premier League clubs keep making it this far in European competitions, or are you more apathetic in general towards the performance of other Premier League clubs in Europe?
To a point, I think I do enjoy watching the other English teams in Europe to some extent. I think that it, you know, it obviously builds the reputation of the league. I think that it's a really good, I think sometimes it helps justify to yourself, you know, when you do have a bad season in the Premier League, and you can kind of look at the overall strength of the Premier League in comparison to other leagues. And you can kind of say, okay, you know, like maybe, you know, we're sitting in fourth, fifth in the English Premier League, but it's sometimes not a good barometer of how actually good of a team you are. Sometimes I find your league position in the Premier League. So, I do enjoy it for that point of view. But obviously, as a Chelsea fan, I would rather not be playing Manchester City in the final. I would have taken PSG any day. and I definitely didn't enjoy watching Liverpool win the Champions League a few years back. So,
nor did
to a point.
I don't take pride in it per se. Though, like with Stephen, it is not prideful, but kind of makes me feel better about Arsenal not being as good because we are in a very tough league, I guess. So I would not say I take pride in it. As you say, I'm not English. And even if I was, I don't think I'd take that much pride in it. I can never know for sure, but that just doesn't seem like something I'd do. But it does, it is at least interesting that I see a lot of people say the Premier League has fallen off because like teams don't have as many points as, or they don't, or either you have the last couple of years where City and Liverpool ran away with it, and people say, oh, the league fell off because they ran away with it. Or you get years like this year, 2015-16, where the point total isn't as high and say, oh, the league fell off because whatever.
Like there wasn't an elite team.
Yeah, it's interesting people will say that. And then also, like, guys, we keep making, or not we, I guess there is some pride in it saying we, but the English teams keep making European finals and keep doing extremely well in competitions with everyone in Europe. So clearly it's pretty good. The level of the Premier League is very, very high. So I like it from that it backs up my opinion that the Premier League is not only not falling off, but in one of its better, stronger positions in the last, you know, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And obviously, it's a very ephemeral conversation, hard to pin down a specific answer. But where do you think the Premier League ranks kind of among the big European five at present?
Oh, but personally, I think it's easily the best. I think that, you know, obviously, from a Chelsea fan, I got a really good look at La Liga recently. And I think that the standard of those teams this season in the Champions League spoke for itself. I think that we wiped the floor with them, to be honest. And I think that, you know, that was even a Chelsea side that hadn't, especially in the Atletico Madrid match, it was a Chelsea side that hadn't quite built up to kind of what they are now, even coming into the last few weeks of the season as well. And, you know, Atletico Madrid at that time were top of the league in La Liga. I think that, you know, you're seeing PSG not quite able to get across the line as well. There's good teams scattered across every league in Europe, obviously. But I think what you would say about the Premier League is that the strength and depth of the teams, you know, having teams like West Ham and Leicester and even Everton this season to some extent have performed quite well. These are teams that, you know, I think would actually probably do pretty decently just in the Champions League in general if you look at their starting 11s. So, yeah, I think that it's quite obvious that the Premier League right now is the strongest in the world. And the European Super League is evidence of that because everybody wants us to join.
Yeah, I think the last 4 or 5 years, it's been pretty clearly number one without a whole lot of question. I think there was a reason, it was reasonable to question that prior to the City and Liverpool years, because there was, as much as the Premier League's had the depth for a while, there wasn't that those really top teams. Like maybe I think they had 4 or 5 of the top 10, but no one in the top three. Now you can't even say that because, you know, City might be the best team in the world. Chelsea have been up there lately. Liverpool have been the best team in the world for a lot of the last 3 years. I think it's very clearly the best in the world right now. And I don't think it's been that much of a question for the last couple of years, as much as it absolutely was in question for like the first half of the 2010s.
Yeah. There was some Spanish dominance there for a while. Then Bayern and Dortmund kind of had their turn. But yeah, it definitely seems like the percentage of teams in that upper echelon currently, percentage-wise, England definitely has the advantage at present. All right, now I will talk to you guys about the European Super League, obviously, slash potentially, unfortunately, depending on your guys' view of it. All three of our clubs were involved in the incredibly brief existence of the European Super League. Obviously, we all saw pictures of the protests and everything, but what did you or your fan base think about both the initial announcement and then the very expedited withdrawal from that air quotes competition?
Well, that had to be the craziest 2 days of football Twitter I've ever seen in my life.
The Twitter content was phenomenal.
It was incredible.
It was top tier.
it was honestly like a movie or something. It was insane. Personally, and you know, this will actually be really interesting coming from three foreign fans, I guess, because I suppose if you are one of these prospectors of the European Super League, where probably your target, you know, where the supposedly the fans that, you know, don't really have that much love for the classic English structure of the league and, you know, the Champions League and all these things. Personally, I was infuriated by it. I wrote a big article at the time kind of exposing the key players behind it and had really great dialogue with a lot of Chelsea supporters about kind of our position on it. And the Chelsea supporters trust as well did a great job. This is just talking from a Chelsea standpoint, obviously. Kind of organizing that protest. Obviously, the day, you know, you can argue who pulled out first, was the City, was it Chelsea, who knows? But I was really proud with the reaction of the team. But it is kind of that that thing where once it's been done, you can't really undo it. And I think that a lot of fans are going to hold these scars for a long time, knowing how it was kind of all done slippery behind our back. It was kind of a thing where nobody really heard about anything happening with it, and then one day we all refreshed our Twitter feeds and there it was, the European Super League had popped out of nowhere. So I think that it was the slimy way that it was kind of done behind our back, and it was just the disregard for any fan opinion about the subject as well that left a super bad sour taste in the mouth. Glad to be rid of it for now, and hoping that Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus can officially put the nail in the coffin as well. But with Perez so strongly attached to the project, who knows where this goes from here?
Yeah, I was unhappy with it. I probably wasn't as furious as some. Or I did not like it, but I also knew in the back of my mind that I would probably get used to it if it happened and get over it. But I did not like it, and I'm happy it's dead, or mostly dead. As far as our fan base on the whole, we were foaming at the mouth mad, like figuratively and possibly literally, I don't really know. And it only fractured what was already a very bad relationship between the fans and the Kroenkes. As we saw, there were large protests outside the Emirates for the Kroenkes to go. I don't really think it will end up meaning anything, but it just kind of made a bad relationship even worse, which is not a whole lot of fun for people who have to deal with that, but That's their fault. They did an incredibly stupid decision. And I'm honestly a bit insulted by just how poorly the whole thing was set up. Like, if they really did this right, if they did this right, this would have worked. But they didn't do any planning. There was no plan for any of this.
The biggest indictment of that was the website, if any of you guys saw that. It was just atrocious.
They didn't get any sponsorship, like, certainties. Like, come on, if you had the money, you could have, this would have happened. Like, there's not that much we can do. If they had the money, it happens. And they were just so wholly unprepared. And they were like, yeah, this will work. We said so. And it just, like, come on. I'm quite insulted by how poorly it was done. It was attempted, because, like, man, you really should have, this should have worked, and you just screwed it up so badly. Like, it should have worked, and somehow it wasn't even close to working because it was so poorly done. I'm honestly quite insulted by that.
Well, I think part of what happened there was that it sounds like, and obviously everything we hear about this is probably coming from the Premier League clubs that backed out, but that they thought that there was, like, an exploratory thing going on into the idea of this, and that they were caught off guard by both the launch of the website and by literally that night Florentino saying that they were going to start playing in August, which I think is why it felt so half-baked, is I think literally Real Madrid were like, it's next year, and everybody else was like, what? But I'll say from a Tottenham perspective, I fully agree with the fan reaction. It was also mine of like, yeah, this is a really, really terrible idea. And Stephen, as you said, we were definitely the target demo, because I was thinking they're probably just going to try to do what the ICC did. The International Champions Cup, is that what they called it? Where they travel to different cities. So like we'd get to see Tottenham versus Real Madrid in like November or something like that in New York or some kind of locale in that kind of idea. But yeah, obviously it went super poorly. But one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this was not just that I spent the last 2 weeks moving, so I wasn't able to come on, but that Tottenham really needed this money. And so while as a fan, I'm right with you guys. I think it was a terrible idea. I do agree with you, Dan, that it probably would have worked if they had thought it through a bit more. But with the stadium expenses, but then all of a sudden no ticket revenue, with coming hopefully contracts for Kane and Son, or if not, then we're probably in even more trouble, with a payout for Mourinho, which we fortunately got cut by a factor of 10 because Roma managed to hire him before the season even ended. Tottenham just really are not in a good financial place. And I think what you're seeing with a lot of the clubs that were involved, maybe just barring City and Chelsea, is that the rest of them are kind of slipping in status, including Madrid, including Barcelona. We were just talking about how La Liga clearly not at the heights that it used to be. Juventus currently on track for a Europa League spot in Italy. PSG struggling to get the title, currently 3 points back with, I think, just 2 matches left for Lille. So it's a lot of these clubs that have been giants for a long time, plus Tottenham, that were trying to kind of just say, stop the count, sorry for the meme, while these clubs are at the top, because other clubs are catching up to them, like in Italy, like what Atalanta are doing under Gasperini, or in England, where, like we were talking about, Rodgers continually pushing up there what West Ham have been able to accomplish this year. It's just a whole bunch of clubs that haven't done enough to continue to establish their elite status. So they're just trying to stop anybody else from being able to get there, because the money that was being talked about was absurd. And I think as a club, Tottenham probably needed that more than a lot of the other clubs involved. But as a fan, still glad it fell through. Still curious to see how Tottenham kind of get around the financial ramifications of it not ending up existing. But, you know, time will all tell in that regard, I suppose.
Someone I follow on Twitter did make the point that the fact that this happened so quickly and seemed to be so half-baked could suggest that there are real deep financial problems for a lot of these clubs, and this was their Band-Aid, and now the Band-Aid isn't there, and we may see the blood flowing out because just with COVID and with those clubs being in horrible financial positions, some of them. I believe Milan, Madrid, Barca, and Juve are all in quite bad positions financially. I don't know exactly how bad, but I think all of those teams have real problems. So, and this was their fix. And without that fix, we'll see how it goes for them in the next couple of years. Because I definitely believe that there could that this was a desperate move more than as much as an opportunist move. I think there may be some real problems for a lot of these clubs behind the scenes, which is why they wanted to do it now with COVID and all that.
I think you can definitely see the clubs who are in the most financial trouble here, because they're the ones who have kind of stuck to this through the fan kind of crusade against the project. You know, you're seeing Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus still kind of holding on to this. And I think what you both said is really true about, you know, the fact that their status is dropping kind of year in, year out. If they are unable to continue to compete at the highest level financially, and, you know, these teams have no one to blame but themselves. You know, they go out and they splash the cash to kind of keep up with everyone else. And, you know, you can argue that the whole game is imbalanced in that way, and that the Premier League would obviously have a massive advantage if these teams didn't go out and spend. But at the end of the day, you have to do what is financially right by the fans, the club, the entire kind of sporting institution as a whole, because you're not just talking about the continuation of, you know, Real Madrid at the top of La Liga. You're talking about, you know, hundreds, thousands of people's jobs day in, day out as well. You're talking about millions of fans across the world who, you know, they want Real Madrid to do well, I'm sure, in La Liga and the Champions League, but I bet a hell of a lot of more money that they want to just exist as well. So I think these clubs have been mismanaged for years, decades even, if you look at the case of Real Madrid and the Galacticos. And I think now that this was a desperate move from a lot of those clubs, and I think that this could have serious ramifications for a lot of teams.
Are you telling me spending more than $100 million on 30-year-old Eden Hazard wasn't a good financial decision?
I think the total fee they've paid to us so far is $169 million. So, yeah. Let that
And I'm sorry, he's 30 now. He would have been like 28 at the time, but still.
28, I think, yeah. Yeah. I don't think El Chiringuito TV is that happy with that decision.
What a rant that was. But yeah, I think weirdly, I was talking to my fiance during the 48 hours that the ESL existed. And she was asking what this probably meant for Harry Kane. And I was like, this is probably the worst possible thing that could happen, because before my argument was that nobody could afford him. And all of a sudden, all these big clubs were going to have an extra 250 to 400 million pounds/euros, depending on what stories you were reading. So weirdly, I think this does the opposite thing, where if all these big clubs are in as financial trouble as they are, nobody can afford him. But then the problem is, if Tottenham are one of the clubs in financial trouble and you can't afford to give him a new contract, but also nobody else can afford to buy him, then you're really screwing yourself, because then you can't be able to get that big sum and reinvest. So it really basically narrows things down to PSG, City, and Chelsea. And Levy says he isn't selling in country. So we'll see what happens.
I was going to say probably United as well, but that doesn't help with the selling in country thing.
Ooh, I don't know if United actually have any money based on some of the Glazer protests, but time will tell for them. All right, we will take a quick break, and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, and we are back. Stephen, we'll keep going with you talking about Chelsea. Obviously, a big win against Manchester City this weekend. What do you think led to this win against a team that's basically en route to winning the title? And what, if any, impact do you think it could have on the rematch, which obviously will occur in the Champions League final, as we alluded to earlier?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, isn't it? Kind of how does this play out with the Champions League final in mind? Just talking about the win itself, it was a really interesting game, because going into it, you might have thought that both teams would have played a kind of an 11 that you'd expect to see in the Champions League final, just kind of continue that momentum that both teams have had. But both managers elected to not play their starting 11s at all. And I think Chelsea made like 5 changes. Man City made something like 8 or 9 even changes to the starting 11 from the Champions League victories. So what it was kind of a test of the squad. And just talking about the game in general, Man City definitely had probably the best of the chances in the first half. And I think that you just have to look at that Aguero Panenka penalty. I don't know what he was thinking there. That obviously would have been a great chance for them to seal the title. And I think with this Chelsea side, what you have to say is that if you give them a sniff, they will take their opportunities. And you saw a lot of the reactions kind of going into halftime from the Chelsea players, from Thomas Tuchel and his staff. They looked really invigorated after that penalty save from Edouard Mendy. And I think that you could tell that they kind of smelt that there was a chance there in that game. And I do think that Pep has this in him, this kind of odd performance where he puts out a lineup that just doesn't kind of look right. He just kind of does fumble the bag sometimes in terms of these tactical performances. Like if you send out your best Man City 11 in that game, you win the title. I think that going into that Champions League final, I think that you have a lot of momentum. You know, you probably don't have to play your big players in the run-in. I think City have got a few easy fixtures as well in this run-in. You can rest players. You can kind of build those squad players up for the final and see if anyone performs those last few games and breaks their way into the team. But by kind of swapping the team just to your B side for a game where, you know, you may say the title's already wrapped up, but you can win it there and then on that day, I think was a big missed opportunity for them. In terms of the Chelsea side of things, obviously the win itself was probably slightly fortuitous, winning it in the last minute with Alonso, just one of the most clutch players ever somehow. I think it will be good for our momentum, just kind of especially for that kind of B squad mentality, just kind of getting a few of those guys playing. Seeing Ziyech score a goal obviously was really, really great for us as well. He's been someone who's been kind of getting a lot more opportunities off the bench. Christian Pulisic as well, looking quite good. Reece James had a man of the match performance. So a few of these guys who didn't start the Real Madrid game all kind of were able to perform at a level where we can now see that they can compete with, you know, these City players. So I think it does build up major confidence for the final. It does kind of scare me knowing that we've beaten them twice in the last month. You know, we've probably just poked the sleeping bear to some extent. So I think that everything is on the line now for this final. It was anyway, but I would obviously have rather won these games going into it than losing them as well. So I think this Chelsea team does seem to feed off confidence. And I think that the last few months of games and, you know, the clean sheets as well that we've been keeping, obviously didn't keep a clean sheet in this game, but in general been keeping clean sheets a lot, I think has been really building a lot of confidence in this team. And I don't want to jinx it, but I do think we are in a great position coming into this final.
Yeah, I totally agree with the momentum thing. It feels good to see yourself beat a team like that, because then you know that you can. So I totally agree with that side of it, and with Pep maybe overthinking it a touch, which a lot of people accuse him of. But he just showed that wasn't an issue with him in the PSG match, after being kind of labeled that way for a long time as that kind of like almost man when it comes to the European competitions. But yeah, I definitely agree with you. I'd much rather be the team that was coming off a win than the one that wasn't, even if it meant that you got to preserve some of your more interesting tactical ideas. But Guardiola, while being an expert tactician, doesn't really mix things up all that much. It tends to stay at least in the same family of ideas. So I'm not really sure how much benefit came from this risk, which obviously did not pay off in the short term at the least. I also wanted to talk about another big win for Chelsea. Obviously, we're big fans of the women's game here on the show, and you secured yet another title. Just wanted to talk to you a little bit about that and the manager, who is currently drawing a lot of praise in the media.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you alluded to, Kevin, the women, Chelsea women's side beat Reading 5-0 on the final day of the season in the WSL, and Emma Hayes' side lifted the title. So that was obviously a great day for the club. Yeah, and like you say as well, Emma Hayes herself, I think, deserves massive credit for this, because this is back-to-back titles now. I think it's her fourth Women's Super League title at the club as well. So she's probably she is the most successful manager in any Chelsea manager in history. So that's obviously something we can all get behind. And just looking at this team as well, it's such a great team. They've got people like Francesca Kirby, who's just had her all-time best season as well, and Samantha Kerr, who is actually from my hometown in Australia. So seeing someone from my hometown play up front for a Chelsea side and winning a title and playing so well is obviously just great. It's awesome. And obviously, as well, I have to say that the Chelsea women's side are in the Champions League final as well. First time in history that the men's and the women's side have been in the Champions League final in the same year. Everything's looking really, really good for that side at the moment. They play Barcelona on May the 16th, less than a week from now. And just wishing them all the best going into that final. I'll be watching.
Yeah, a lot of really talented players in that Barcelona side as well. I think mm-hmm. Jenny Hermoso, right, that plays for the Spanish national team as well. If people can figure out how to watch it, which is always the issue with the women's game, if you can figure out how to watch that final, it'll definitely be worth a watch with some of the biggest stars in the women's game all facing one another. And then I'll finish up talking Chelsea with you a little bit about Tuchel, who obviously you mentioned there, obviously has improved the defense a lot. But when he was hired, a lot of the talk was he was kind of being brought in to resuscitate some of your summer signings, most notably Werner and Havertz, who weren't really hitting the ground running previously under Frank Lampard. Havertz has kind of turned things around quietly of late. Timo Werner always involved, although it seems he doesn't really understand the concept of offside. But I was just curious if you felt he'd kind of passed the standard in that regard of getting the most out of maybe the Germans or the rest of your summer signings.
Yeah, well, I have to be honest a bit. I have to expose myself a little bit here, because when Tuchel was first appointed, I wasn't fully on board with it as a fan. I'd seen what he'd done at obviously PSG and Dortmund and his might side as well, but something about him didn't scream exactly what we needed. You know, Tuchel's reputation in Europe was as this kind of obviously he had a reputation as like a gegenpress kind of student. You know, the same mold as like a Ragnick or a Jurgen Klopp and the Nagelsmann, these kind of guys, and creating this attacking, free flowing football. And it was something that we didn't really struggle with under Lampard, was scoring goals. Ironically, it was obviously the defense. And what I've been really impressed with Tuchel is that he's kind of come in and done the opposite to what I expect him to do. He's reverted to more of like a Conte kind of three at the back style, but having these fullbacks push so far on that it doesn't really ever feel like a five at the back like it did under Conte. It feels like a true 3-4-3. He's done really well just tightening up their defense. Obviously, our goal scoring, as I'm sure has been well documented across all of Europe, could be a lot better. And our chance scoring to our chance creation does not level out at all. But definitely, like you say, he has kind of got a tune out of Werner and Havertz. And Werner's obviously a kind of a basket case player this season to some extent. He's, you know, the open goal miss chances that he's had is just ridiculous. And I think that you'd have to say that just looking at it objectively, he has been quite disappointing in that regard. But also, he's probably going to end the season with something like 25 goal contributions in all competitions. So, I don't know kind of what maybe we expected. Maybe we were expecting this kind of 30 goal scoring guy season. I don't know anymore. But probably the big one you'd have to say is Havertz, because I think that under Lampard, the main criticism that I would give Lampard, obviously I love the guy to death, but the big criticism I'd give him with Havertz is that I don't think that he ever really found Havertz his best position. He tried playing him at first on the right wing, which just looked really awkward. It didn't look like it suited him at all. Then he dropped him back into this kind of eight, which is what a lot of people think that maybe his long-term position will be in a team. But he didn't really have the tenacity to kind of continue the press in the same way that a Mason Mount looked incredible at in those kind of similar positions. So what Tuchel's done by just kind of putting him in this position, this kind of false nine position that he played so well at, obviously in Germany and Leverkusen towards the back end of last season, has really brought out the best in him. And I think that what I would actually say is he's kind of played in a similar way to what I've been used to seeing from like a Firmino in the last few years, which is kind of obviously hold up the ball, play in for like a Werner and Mount recently on that right-hand side of Pulisic as well. And just kind of like link the play and be also just a focal point for the team, which is, just something that we've sorely lacked, especially when we tried playing Werner in those positions on the odd occasion this season as well. So I've been really impressed with Tuchel. Obviously, I think that he's done an incredible thing in getting this side into the Champions League final. Not what I expected from the season, if you had asked me in January at all. If anything, I think he's come into a side where you've got experienced winners in this team. Says Azpilicueta and N'Golo Kante. Thiago Silva, obviously, being brought to the club this summer. So I think a lot of these players have played key roles in kind of getting this side back to where it should be.
Gotcha. Well, with much chagrin, I will congratulate you on what has turned out to be a pretty decent season. We were even talking before the show. It's been a bit topsy-turvy, but it's better than the kind of constant poor performances that we've seen from some of the other clubs around you. And like you said, made it to the Champions League final when not many people expected that at the start of the year or even in the middle of it. So well done you, I guess. We'll come to you now, Dan, to talk a little bit about Arsenal. There have been a lot of criticisms made about Arsenal's season thus far. Obviously not anywhere near where you'd like to be, although it's to your credit that in the offseason you said that Dave and I were being a little bit too generous about some of the stuff that you had done in the offseason. And so maybe this isn't a big surprise to you, but like I said, criticisms are abound, but it seems like not a lot of it is sticking to Arteta for some reason. It'll either go to the players or it'll go to ownership. I'm just curious which things and how much of your struggles do you think are specifically Arteta's fault, kind of unrelated to the other two, if possible?
I'd say our inability to attack and just the general lack of speed that we play with is pretty clearly an Arteta philosophy. Like that's on purpose. A big thing is we have a lot of slow buildup. And then eventually, I think the goal is to eventually build up very slowly and then speed up when we're in like the penalty box area, but we very rarely get to that point. And it just means we don't attack very well. We've never had a good attack under Arteta. At any time he's been here. So that's a pretty huge criticism of him, considering the players we have with Bukayo Saka and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Lacazette, Emile Smith-Rowe, Martin Odegaard, Nicolas Pepe, etc. As much as I think some of those players, some aren't what they used to be, and some maybe we may have paid a bit more money than we should have for one in particular. They're still not. They're better attacking players than our output would suggest. Like as a team, we have 46 goals in the season, and it's not like we've been incredibly unlucky. We have 49 expected goals, but which is, you know, a slight underperformance, but not. It's not like if we had 49 goals, I'd be happy with it. It's nowhere near a top level attack. With maybe players that aren't at the top level, but also aren't as poor as we've been. So I'd say just the general inability to score goals, which is pretty important in this game. That is nothing is wholly a coach's fault because players are just more important. But I think that's a pretty obvious point where we struggle due to the philosophy and the tactics that he intentionally tries to play with. I think that is a pretty clear thing that does fall back on Arteta more so than the players and much more so than the ownership.
Gotcha. Obviously you name dropped without name dropping Aubameyang there, who you obviously gave a large sum of money to recently, obviously has struggled this year. A recent article came out where he kind of discussed his battle with malaria this season and everything going on around the pandemic and stuff. Obviously, from a human side, that has kind of explained some of his struggles. Do you think that has heavily exacerbated kind of the negative narrative surrounding him? I know you didn't think it was a good contract at the time, but do you think maybe people have gone a little bit too far and have shielded themselves away from the personal aspect?
People have always been weird about Aubameyang. I've never got it because he seems like a great dude. A bit corny at times, but who cares? Like, he definitely not bad. Like, absolute worst thing I could describe him as corny, but like, he seems like a good dude. And people really don't like him for some reason. Even when he was good, it was kind of like there was almost a begrudging admiration for him, and I don't know why at all.
XG people don't like him because he often outperforms it.
He doesn't. He actually doesn't. He outperformed it last season, but on the whole, for his career, he has not been that guy. It was more just like people. I think the issues with him was more people thought he was better than he was last season, particularly because he overperformed it. But regardless, not talking about that. I think he struggled before the malaria. He's actually been better the second half of the season. I don't know how. I did not read the article, so I don't know how the COVID stuff specifically has impacted him. But I think he's just had a season that is not shocking for an aging striker. And I think personal criticism is extremely unfair. I think he absolutely works his ass off, and I think he gives it all the time. I definitely don't think this is he's just lazy and he got his money, so he doesn't care anymore thing. He's just aging. And like I said this at the time we offered him the contract, there's been a clear decline in his underlying numbers specifically for the past four seasons. Now, as I said at the time, that also coincided with the team's getting worse. So is that on him? Is that because the teams are bad or because he's old or both? I didn't know at the time. I still can't be sure now because the team has continued to get worse. But I definitely think it's at least both. He's getting older and he's getting worse. That's how that works. But I don't think it's for lack of trying. I don't think it's for lack of, hyper-masculine leadership or whatever. I just think he's getting older, and that happens. And that's something we as a club should have accounted for. And I don't think we did. So I can't blame him for it.
Gotcha. Well, somebody at the other end of the age spectrum, Nicolas Pepe, hasn't particularly impressed since joining, but 7 goals and 2 assists isn't too bad in all competitions since the turn of the year, since the start of 2021. Do you think this is in any way kind of a turning point for him to kind of resuscitate his Arsenal career, which has kind of seen him miss out of a lot of matches for other players at that right wing spot? Or do you think this is just kind of a blip in an overall disappointing trend?
I'd be more optimistic if he was further on the other end of the age spectrum, because he's not as young as you'd think. I believe he's either about to turn 26 or is already 26. He turns 26 at the end of the month. So if he was like 22, 23, I would be much more optimistic, but he's not. So he's been good in the Europa League this season, but his Premier League numbers are still pretty average. He scored a great goal today, but not that it doesn't encourage me. Goals are always good, but and that was a gorgeous goal to watch. Incredible skill to convert it, but it's not something that you can expect to get consistently. Like, you, if you only score screamers and you're supposed to score goals, that's probably not good, because screamers are screamers for a reason. They don't happen that often. And when your best attribute for teams, your goal scoring, and like, I not that I don't care if you score gorgeous goals, do it, like, that's great. But that's not something that's going to turn my opinion on you. Like, that is a great thing to have in your locker, but if that's the best thing you have in your locker, that's really bad. Especially, and even taking out the fee, just as a 26-year-old attacker, you just need to be getting better shots. And that, those aren't the things that encourage me. It'd be more encouraging if he scored a tap-in from the penalty, penalty spot. That'd be much more encouraging to me than scoring these screamers that he does every once in a while. So as far as him in the hole, I'd say he's had a slightly better second season than first, but still, I mean, we can forget about him trying to justify the fee. We just have to forget about that. That's not going to happen. It's just about trying to be a positive attacker. I'm still not sure he's that. So, again, not great, but I don't think he's as bad as he was last season, but I think he's only marginally better.
Gotcha. Well, sounds like a lot of disappointing players there. So maybe we'll just stick with you as we head into Player Watch. We're going to discuss players that might be on the way out of our clubs come the transfer window. So, yeah, Dan, let's start with you in Arsenal. Seems like you might have quite the list based on some of your comments just now.
The difference between players that will leave and I want to leave are very different. Because there are some young players such as Bukayo Saka and Emile Smith Rowe. Those are the main two. Also Gabriel Martinelli, who I am very, very optimistic with and think are can be very good. And I like them. And there are some others as well. Kieran Tierney, I like. He can stay. Thomas Partey, I've been pretty underwhelmed with, but we just signed him, so he's staying. And I don't hate that. He's still probably our best midfielder, even if I don't think it's a very good signing. He is at least a pretty good player. But a lot of players, I would just be like, yeah, you can leave. But that doesn't mean they will. Willian, for one, I would love to get rid of Willian. That's not happening. He's on too much money. He's too old. We're not going to move him. We are absolutely stuck with him, and it's so frustrating how incredibly predictable that was. Because you can go back on this podcast and see me and listen to me be very unhappy with the signing of him, because it was so obviously not going to work. It never made sense under any circumstance, and we did it anyway, which is frustrating. But people like such as him, such as even Rob Holding, who just signed a new contract, Callum Chambers, lots of center backs in particular who are quite average. And I would love to move on, but we won't be able to because they're on too much money and no one's going to pay for them. Cedric Suarez, not a center back, but another defender who is in a similar position. There are lots of players I would like to get rid of. As far as players I actually think are going to move on, Hector Bellerin is my favorite player at the club right now, but it looks like there's a good chance he will leave, which my heart is very sad about. But if we get significant money for him, my head knows that's probably a decent deal. He's been the one who's linked away most often. I think Lacazette, there's a good chance he leaves. I'm really concerned we're going to give him an extension and do the same thing we just did with Aubameyang. But I hope he leaves, and not because he's bad, just because the age doesn't make sense to extend him. And I'd rather get something for him now than nothing for him at the end of his contract. Those are probably the two I'm most confident in seeing either a sale or an extension in Lacazette's case. I do think still sale is more likely. And there's lots of players I want to leave, but I don't know how many actually will.
Gotcha. And then coming to you, Steven, any pending outgoings from Chelsea? It seems like on the other end, you're about to get Thiago Silva to come back.
Yeah, well, hopefully that is one of the first things that we do is re-sign Thiago Silva for another season. I think that Fabrizio Romano has been reporting that it's been pretty close for a while, and I think it's just a matter of time on that one. So that's some positive news. On the outgoing, I think there are a couple predictable ones. I think Emerson Palmieri will almost certainly be leaving the club. Which is a bit of a shame because I think that I do think that he would have made a really good kind of deputy for Chilwell, but I think with what you've seen, even just in this past week, with what Alonso does offer is kind of that X factor, that kind of clutch goal, and I think that that's just something that Emerson can't compete with. So I do think we probably will be seeing him leave, and a few other players I think that have just kind of been bloating the squad for a while, because even though I am really happy with our depth at the moment, I do think that there are a lot of positions that are kind of overfilled to some extent. I would expect to see definitely Olivier Giroud leave the club. And if we are going to sign a striker, which it does look like we are, I would probably also sadly expect to see Tammy Abraham leave the club as well. He has.
Could we have
really...
him, please?
50, 60 mil maybe, but no.
Oh, God, no.
it's so sad with Tammy because I genuinely think that whoever he goes to, he's going to become one of the best strikers in the Premier League. I think the guy just is just such an elite goal scorer. And if he is really given the chance to flourish, then he will score goals. I think it is just as simple as that. Play Temi up front, get the balls into him. He will put it away. He's a good finisher, and he's still super young for a striker of his kind of type. Usually, you know, these kind of these bigger guys, they start scoring a lot of goals into their late 20s. And I think that, yeah, whatever team kind of invests in him will reap the rewards, sadly. And it won't be Chelsea, more than likely, now.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. I would happily pay $60 million for him, but we probably don't have that. So sad.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the ironic thing is that, yeah, I do think he would actually do well at Arsenal. And I think if you do dig deep into his background, I do think actually a lot of his family are Arsenal fans. So, you know, maybe on the cards, maybe not. I would probably doubt us selling someone like that to you guys, unfortunately for you. But yeah, apart from that, if we do sign a centre-back, I'd probably expect Kurt Zouma to go. But I'd probably at this stage, looking at his goal contributions and him as just a backup player in general, I probably wouldn't sign a centre-back, so I wouldn't get rid of him either. So yeah, it'd probably just be those main two up front that I'd expect to leave, Giroud and Abraham and Emerson as well. And that'd probably be our outgoings, I'd say.
Gotcha. Well, it seems like Arsenal on all of your old players, Tottenham on all of your ex-managers. must feel like a pretty interesting time as a Chelsea fan, watching everybody that leaves your club be wanted by in-city rivals with fans that also come on the show.
It's great. Obviously, you just get to keep tabs on them.
Right. Exactly. Yeah,
I feel this is an unfair deal where we don't get Tammy Abraham, but we get Willian. I feel like we're getting a short end of the stick here.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely fair. I don't want to miss out on some of our other managerial targets just because we had Jose. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, maybe just stop picking up the phone from ex-Chelsea people in general. But obviously, that's not where the links end on this show, because next match, you guys are going to be facing each other in the Premier League. So, Stephen, we'll start off with you. What are you expecting from this one?
Yeah, sorry, Dan. I do expect us to probably capitulate this to continue our good form and to win this game. I think that we'll probably see our full strength side back, and we'll just kind of get this momentum building into the FA Cup final. And I think that Tuchel is going to set at a very clear target from this point to win every single game to the end of the season. I think that obviously up until the Man City game, I think that if you look at our fixtures, we can set that goal and have it be achievable. I also think that, talking about what we talked about earlier, if we do win the game against Arsenal, I would pretty reasonably say that top four would be locked at that point then. So that's something we should be aiming to do. Hopefully the team's focus isn't kind of drifting to those later games, and we can kind of focus up on this game, because as we've seen already this season, you know, Chelsea aren't averse to letting Arsenal just absolutely dunk us when we want to. So we'll definitely need to be at full attention, because it probably is, I guess we'll have to find it from Dan after, but it probably is a little bit of a free hit for Arsenal, I suppose, which is obviously dangerous, because those are kind of the games where Chelsea do seem to slip up, looking at the West Brom games this season, when teams just kind of identify us as this team where they can just go all out against, I guess. So, yeah, I expect a win. I think that this team is good enough to go win, and probably to win well with Arsenal's current kind of predicament and form. But I wouldn't rule out an absolute crazy thing.
Yeah, I'm expecting pain. Lots of pain. and our all out is taking 25 passes to get up the pitch instead of 30. So, I don't know. You might be all right. I have no expectations for this game. If we get something, it doesn't even really matter. Like, our season's done. It was done when we went out of Europa League on Thursday. There's really nothing for us to play for, and there's absolutely something for Chelsea to play for, and they're a better team than us, so I'm not expecting anything. Granted, I wasn't expecting anything when we played Chelsea earlier, and we somehow beat them, so anything's possible, but expectations-wise, they're low, and I'm expecting a lot of pain.
Gotcha, and the one way you avoided pain is I didn't bring up the Europa League on the show, so... never say that I'm not benevolent.
Yes, Kevin has saved me. Thank you.
You are quite welcome.
Doing a lot better than Mikel Arteta with that.
All right. We'll leave things there. So if you guys would like to tell folks that they can find you or anything you've been working on, now would be a great time.
Yeah. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, you can find me on Twitter at StephenClark264, where I've been dropping recently a lot of articles talking about the aforementioned Super League and the upturn in Chelsea's form at the end of the season. And I'd be expecting to be tweeting a lot, hopefully, for a great end of the season where we can hopefully win the Champions League. So, yeah, you can find me there.
Yeah, thanks for listening. And you can find me on Twitter at @_jersey_fits. And there will be lots of pain for that Chelsea game. But hey, normally I'm not a terrible follow. So.
And you're a decent human being, as I once so famously said.
Decent human being.
And is in your bio. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on Twitter at Kevroff. You can find the show on Twitter at EPL Roundtable. And obviously, you can find it on all of your podcasting apps under the name EPL Roundtable, which you likely had to do in order to hear me saying this right now. So well done, you. But thanks to you two so much for joining me today. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.